From the author of Putin's Wars comes an essential new military history of Russia from its beginnings to today.
Mark Galeotti, a leading scholar of Russian security affairs,
delivers a masterful history of how war and insecurity has driven Russia's destiny for centuries, including the disastrous invasion of Ukraine. This is the book you need to understand Putin's grip on power in the East, the war in Ukraine, and Russia's future on the global stage.
Forged in War is out now from Osprey Publishing. Order your copy wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast. As always, the podcast is sponsored by The Nation and widely available on all podcasting formats. This week, we're going to do something a little bit different. Recently, I was asked to deliver a talk at Carleton University for a conference they held on the future of political journalism. My talk was titled, Fact Checking Won't Save Democracy. It takes up a lot of issues relevant towards the last election, both the liberal reliance on fact-checking as a way of challenging Trump, but also why this approach doesn't really work. And more broadly, it's about how the political divide is no longer between left and right, but between pro-system and anti-system politics. And how the mistake that liberals make is not understanding that the claims of anti-system politics are not factual claims and can't be refuted factually. They are, in fact, what philosophers call normative claims, claims about values, and therefore have to be contested on the plane of values. The talk was very well received, and a lot of the ideas are ones I've been working through in my writing as well. I thought it'd be of great interest to listeners of this podcast. So here's the talk, and we'll be back next week for more debate and dialogue. So it's a great honor to be here, and I'm especially happy after the opening words of Adrian and of Alan Thompson, because actually a lot of the issues that they raised are exactly what I'm trying to grapple with. And my speech is a little bit of a provocation. It's to try to think about why something that is one of the best parts of journalism, this sort of commitment to facts, to really getting our facts right, why it isn't quite working, and to think maybe of strategies around it. And there's so many very experienced people, both at the start of their career, but also well along their career, who in this room, that I'm actually especially looking forward to the question and answer period, because I think that the issues I'm grappling with are something that we're all dealing with. My title of my talk was, fact-checking won't save democracy, and I noticed some amusement at the thing, and it was meant in a little bit of a spirit of irony or paradox, because one would think, whoever thought fact-checking could save democracy, but it actually happens to be the case that over the last, especially 10 years or so, there's been a real resurgence of fact-checking and a shift in the role of fact-checking within journalism. And fact-checking was seen as one of the great bulwarks against some of the dangers that Adrian and Alan had mentioned. And I think that it hasn't quite worked out as one might have hoped. And I think we have to ask why. Fact-checking... it's suffering the same problems of journalism at large. So when I say fact-checking is the subject, the fact-checking has the same crisis that we face in this age of polarization, of people living in their own media bubbles, of disparate and not always reliable sources of truth. I first heard of fact-checking when I was a teenager in the 1980s from a novel called Bright Lights, Big City by Jay McInerney, which was later made into a movie with Michael J. Fox. I don't know how many people here have read that novel. Oh, a few of them. Oh, that's good. The main character, it's a very much a 1980s novel, which will say there's a lot of cocaine use in it. The main character in the novel works for a nameless magazine, which is, of course, The New Yorker, at the Department of Factual Verification, and he's a fact checker.
And this is seen as a kind of quirky, odd New Yorker thing. And then, in the novel, all the sort of lore, the legendary lore of fact-checking of how, you know, if you say that there are 13 steps up City Hall, you know, you have to go and count those steps. And this is, you know, like anyone who's dealt with high-level magazine fact-checking knows this. Unfortunately, my friend Nora Loretta won't be here, but she told me once, she wrote an article for the Walrus about how the importance of Christmas carols in her family. And so they called up Nora's mother to say, did you actually sing Christmas carols when you were growing up? But that sort of fact-checking is the sort of behind-the-scenes fact-checking. Often done by traditionally like very young women who are just out of journalism school, and is that sort of that's what it traditionally was, and it really goes back to Time magazine in the 1920s, the New Yorker in the 1920s, that were started to become national magazines, worried about libel, wanted to establish their credibility, and really built up these enormous fact checking departments. But something shifted. Really, Trump is maybe one emblem, but I actually think it goes back a little bit before. And there's a figure that I think many of you here will know, Daniel Dale, who used to be at the Toronto Star and is now at CNN. And it was the time of Rob Ford as mayor of Toronto. And Daniel became a celebrity first in Canada and then the larger world once the Ford story blew up, because he had this amazing gift of fact-checking Rob Ford. He had knew the type of lies that Ford told. He had a very good ability to both remember previous lies and then also figure out if new statements are dodgy and how they can be checked. And he would often do this both for the Toronto Star and Twitter. And then this built a real reputation and very much earned. I mean, he was doing a real service with Ford, and then was hired by CNN once Trump came on. And with the emergence of Donald Trump in 2015, we get this, what had become a kind of Toronto problem became a North American or global problem. Because these two politicians, not totally the same, but I mean, they had the similar disregard for truth. And with the rise of Donald Trump, you had this issue of so-called fake news, disinformation, and the belief that journalism has to respond to this crisis. That there was when Trump's first election, there was this story that went around that the Pope had endorsed Trump, and this was like a totally made-up story, but it turned out to be had created by one of these journalism mills in Eastern Europe that was just doing it to get clicks, to get advertising money, which then existed on the internet, and then it spread. And so there was the idea that both Trump is lying, and also there's a culture that the consensus of truth was breaking down. And so, you needed to elevate fact-checking to not something that's done in the back doors, behind the scenes. You write the article, then you fact-check it, but something that's actually done up front and involved in the political system. And you get all these newspapers suddenly making their fact-check department prominent and, saying that we will fact-check, politicians. And, I think in 2016, the Washington Post recorded that they had found that in that campaign, Donald Trump had made 30,573 false and misleading statements. I just love the precision of that number, that someone took the trouble to count it. And so suddenly, previously there had been maybe 60 fact-checking labs around the world, and suddenly it started to grow by leaps and bounds, and within a year there were 300, and there were a lot of institutions that were very invested in this. Not to be too cynical, there within journalism there was also this kind of thought, I think, that this is a way in which political journalism could reclaim its role in society and also gain an audience. That there was many people who were upset that Donald Trump was lying, and there became a sort of cottage industry of recording Trump's lies, responding to it, but also more broadly, sort of political journals started to, I think, capitalize on the sort of anti-Trump market. You saw, you know, a plethora of anti-Trump books by journalists. I have to say, most of them not of very high quality. You saw, you know, like the Washington Post rebranded itself, you know, democracy dies in darkness, right? This is the idea that we are the sort of bulwarks of the truth, and we will do the fact-checking. And, you know, a broad swath of the public that was understandably very upset that, you know, this politician who's so dishonest, you know, like really was drawn. And I think, you know, both publications like the New York Times and Washington Post, they saw their subscriptions, you know, really grow based on this, selling themselves as the sort of journalistic check on Donald Trump. Also CNN and MSNBC News. And there was, you know, like, as I mentioned, you know, Daniel Dale, I have, you know, highest respect. A lot of good journalism went into this, but I think it's also worth thinking about that there was also a lot of shoddy journalism, that because there was this kind of, you know, thought to be easy money in, you know, like anti-Trump rhetoric and anti-Trump reporting. And I think this is especially true in the sort of Russiagate matter, the Mueller investigation, which, you know, did find some connections of Trump to Russia. But I have to tell you, like, if you actually look at Trump's history, like, there's far more connections to Saudi Arabia than there is to Russia. Like Trump's son-in-law has, like, you know, runs a $2 billion hedge fund with Saudi money. And that is, like, you know, never raised because Saudi Arabia is an ally, and, you know, and so it becomes a kind of, I don't know, I think journalism's kind of played into certain partisan role, and in a role that I think a lot of people, not just pro-Trump people, but, you know, people who are skeptical of Trump, but might think, like, you know, they're really trying to do something very cheap here. But within the sort of, you know, I think this sort of what we would call this fact-checking bubble that was sort of rising up in 2015, 2016, certain parts of, like, the Democratic Party, like, really had high hopes for this. And, you know, one saw this in, amazingly, in the two debates where Democratic strategists were, like, very hopeful that, like, you know, Trump and J.D. Vance will say false things, and then they'll be fact-checked by the media, and, you know, like, we got you, Donnie, we got him. And this is actually something that, you know, like, I heard Democratic strategists, like, gloat about, like, oh, you know, like, Donald Trump, you know, repeated the big lie, as did J.D. Vance, that, you know, the 2020 election was stolen, and we got you because the fact-checkers will nick them. And, you know, like, and Trump told, like, hideous lies, you know, about Haitians eating cats and dogs. And even J.D. Vance tried to sort of wiggle and say, well, this is a broader truth or whatever. But so there was, like, you know, like, there was ways in which fact checkers could hold them to account. But, you know, like, we've all seen the results of the election, right? This strategy of fact-checking Donald Trump, how did it work out? Now, I have to say, in some ways, one could actually see that it did work out, because there's actually some very good data from this polling from Data for Progress, which showed actually that there's a pattern. Harris won with voters who pay serious attention to political news, while Trump solidified much of his support with voters who don't. So for people who paid, like, a great deal of attention to the news, Harris won by 6%. Whereas people who say they pay no attention at all to the news, Trump won by 19%. So one could say that the people who were paying attention to the fact checkers, like, you know, the Democratic Party strategy of relying on fact checkers to save democracy worked among the people who were reading. You know, one can also cite other evidence that the people who voted for Harris tended to be newspaper readers. Among newspaper readers, she did very well. Whereas people who got their news from YouTube or Reddit voted for Trump. Interestingly, TikTok, because it has a sort of wider female audience is more split than some of the social media. But so there's a way in which one could look at that evidence and say, well, yeah, fact-checking worked. You know, the fact-checkers were able to convince people that Trump lied, except the problem is that this is like a minority and maybe an increasingly shrinking minority of the population that you're convincing. And then there's this other body of the population that you're not. And I mean, in some ways, it's a sort of paradox that, like Harris, even though the election results were poor, she actually increased her vote share compared to Joe Biden in 2020 among people who were older and people who were like earned over $100,000. So basically, like people who read the Globe and Mail and New York Times, like we're won over. We're talking about journalism, not political strategy. But I have to say, if your strategy is like you want to get, you know, the people that read the New York Times and the Globe and Mail to vote for you, then I don't know if that's like, you know, that's where the voters are. You got to go hunting where the ducks are. In a kind of, you know, broader sense, the fact-checking strategy didn't work. And this is also related to how the two campaigns related to things like social media. One thing that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance both did was they went on a lot of podcasts, including very strange podcasts about UFOs and stuff like that. Even in 2016, Trump went on the Alex Jones show. And Alex Jones is like a total like lunatic who believes that Sandy Hooks was faked and that the American elite are all space aliens, you know, like. But he went on that show because that's actually how you reach low propensity voters, people who aren't following the news. And conversely, I mean, there was a big thing about, you know, Kamala Harris apparently wanted to go on the Joe Rogan show, but there was negotiations broke down. But I think the more interesting thing was that there's a very popular left wing podcaster, Hassan Piker. And the Democrats did have a role for influencers at the DNC, but Hassan Piker was kicked out, following millions of people follow this guy on YouTube, was kicked out of the DNC, because the Democrats felt uncomfortable having this guy there. So in some ways, there's this, you know, this alignment with the more mainstream media. I can kind of see it having a political problem. Now, usually I think when we have these conversations, we think about, you know, like, well, what's going on? And I think the one big explanation that we all know is sort of social media and, you know, the rise of social media, fragmentation of society. But I mean, I think, you know, social media only exists within, you know, the broader social world, that the fragmentation that's encouraged by social media is part of a larger fragmentation and automation of social life, and that there is a kind of a more broad breakdown of consensus truth that's just not a matter of media consumption, but a matter of how people live. And it's also reconfigured politics, and I think that this is a kind of crucial point to understand that the we're used to the sort of, you know, political spectrum that came out of the French Revolution of left and right. But I think that in the current moment, the actual political spectrum has been reconfigured, and it is pro-system and anti-system. And I'm deliberately using very neutral kind of terms. One side in the American side where you had, you know, Kamala Harris, but she was like campaigning with Liz Cheney, welcoming the support of Dick Cheney, but also welcoming, you know, to a lesser degree, support from like union members and Bernie Sanders. But basically, this was the party of the system, with maybe Bernie being the fringe member who's like has anti-system instincts, right? But it's basically the party of people who think the American system is basically good and needs reforms here and there, but it's okay. And on the other. And this, to me, is like the classic statement of this is Hillary Clinton in 2016. With, you know, Trump came out with Make America Great Again, and Hillary Clinton said, America has always been great. And, you know, like, America has not always been great. And then, you know, one side in Canada as well, you know, like, you know, Canada's broken, and Chrystia Friedland responded, Canada has never been broken. Well, you know, I think there's a lot of people who have felt that Canada has been at least, you know, broken at some points and might even be broken now. I mean, certainly if I go downtown Regina and I see, you know, the horrific homelessness and drug crisis, you know, So the pro-system politics are basically people who have decided they want to become caretakers of a broken system.
An O'Reilly Auto Parts gift card is the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy-for person. Give the gift of convenience from O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Anti-system politics is, you know, like Trump, but earlier I'd mentioned, you know, Rob Ford. But you look at Trump's coalition, right? Like, look at who he's brought on. RFK Jr., Tulsi Gabbard, Elon Musk. Now, the interesting thing is, like, all these people. I mean, Gabbard ran as a Democrat for the presidency in 2020 in the primaries. RFK Jr. was, a member of this, like, illustrious line bearing the name of one of the great heroes of the Democratic Party, and ran as a Democrat in 2024 and has an actual history, you know, of, like, a lot of left liberal activism. And even Elon Musk, who, you know, apparently seems to have, like, voted for Democrats until, like, this election. And then, so, but all these figures, like, you know, with, I think, RFK Jr., especially with his anti-vaxxing thing, what they have in common is an alignment with anti-system politics. So you have a pro-system and anti-system. And it doesn't have to be, like, left or right. I mean, I think one sees this in figures like Berlusconi, Bolsonaro. These are kind of right-wing populists. But, like, in Mexico, Almo is, very much a sort of social democratic leftist, but, you know, anti-system because he's, like, you know, so widely hated by the elite there. Now, one thing about the anti-system politicians is that their whole basis of support is that their message is the system is corrupt. And it's, like, it has to be taken down. And this, like, is a kind of superpower. Like, it immunizes them against certain things that journalism can normally do. If you have a pro-system politician like Hillary Clinton, and she has a problem with her emails, this becomes a big mark. Like, you're supposed to be the support of the system, and you broke this rule. If you have an anti-system politician, like, Trump's whole message all along was, this system is corrupt. Everyone is corrupt, and I know because I bought and sold politicians. That's what he said in 2016, right? So if you find that, like, a anti-system politician is, like, corrupt, and you throw the legal system at them, or you do the normal political journalism thing of checking corruption, then that actually, like, just makes him stronger because it shows, like, it basically says, oh, the system is trying to destroy him. And one saw this in the classic examples of sort of populist populist sort of politicians with working class roots. There's a mayor in Boston in the early 20th century. Andrew might know the name, Curley. Curley. He went to jail and then, you know, ran for mayor again while in jail and won because he was, like, the candidate of working class Boston of Irish Catholics who, you know, they don't trust the cops. Why should they? So with Marion Barry, the mayor of Washington, D.C., you know, very strong representative with working class black voters in Washington, the FBI went after him. They, like with Rob Ford, they had a video of him, like, smoking crack, and he just said, you know, well, I was set up. And, you know, he served his time, got out, ran for mayor again, and was elected, right? Now you might think, well, what are the voters doing here? But within the logic of anti-system politics, this makes perfect sense, right? Like, if you want somebody who's going to stick it to the man, who's, like, you know, like, going to show all the rich and powerful, the people who support the status quo, what's going on, that they're wrong. You want somebody who's going to give a finger to the established order. You want to give a finger to the readers of the New York Times and the Globe and Mail. And so in some ways, like, I mean, this is a kind of problem that we have as like journalists, in some ways, the very tools that we have of fact-checking and of like, you know, discovering scandal, like the anti-system politician has an immune system to that. Now, how we get around that, you know, one can think about, but I think that it's worth recognizing in these terms. But the rise of anti-system politicians itself is part of a broader crisis, and it's not just a crisis of social media. And I think that one has to think about it in sort of like a crisis of democracy. And I think the one person who maybe is most, for me, illuminating here is the great Marxist thinker Antonio Gramsci, who in the 1920s was, you know, one of the leaders of the opposition to Mussolini, was jailed by Mussolini and died in prison, and had the famous prison notebooks. And in the prison notebooks, he reflects on the sort of the collapse of consensus and the collapse of elite hegemony leading to strongmen. He says that, like, in periods where the great masses have become detached from their traditional ideologies and no longer believe what they usually believe, and he thinks this comes about because of a great crisis, you know, World War I, the Great Depression. These destroy the consensus, and this, in Gramsci's words, opens the door for people offering violent solutions for activities of unknown forces represented by charismatic men of destiny. And, you know, I think that this analysis gets us closer to thinking about, you know, what the real problem is, and why we're living in an age all over the world of, you know, people like Orban, Bolsonaro, Le Pen, you know, like, you know, going back to the beginning of the 20th century, you know, just in terms of the United States, you know, you had first, you know, 9/11, and then Bush with, you know, the war on terror, you know, sold through lies, weapons of mass destruction, and, you know, like some, which a lot of the elite journalists went along with, and some, like Judith Miller, were fired, but others, like Jeffrey Goldberg, you know, at the New Yorker, talked about weapons of mass destruction. He's currently the editor of The Atlantic. So there's like no accountability for this sort of thing. And then followed by the economic crash of 2008. And then, you know, followed by, you know, like in many places, a sort of uneven development increased in, because of the China shocks, increased polarization and economic inequality. I think that these are the actual social realities behind polarization and why that sort of, you know, what Gramsci would talk about, the breaking down of hegemony, the breaking down of consensus. This is the broader reality that has made, unmoored so much of the population, made them so amenable to listening to these anti-system voices. Now, the in terms of how, you know, so these are very big problems, but I think in terms of journalism itself, I think it's worth reflecting ways in which that sort of fact-checking bubble that I talked about failed, and it failed partially because fact-checking was used and weaponized by pro-system people as a way of protecting the status quo and protecting it from legitimate critique. And I'll bring an example. The Washington Post, you know, has a fact-checking thing that they use for the columnists that they use for political primaries. And in 2019, the fact-checker there, Greg Kessler, went after Bernie Sanders for, let me see if I can get this right. So Bernie Sanders had said, three people in this country own more wealth than the bottom half of America. So the Washington Post fact-checker acknowledged, quote, this snappy talking point is based on numbers that add up. But then he went on to say, it's also a question of comparing apples to oranges. According to Kessler, it makes no sense to compare rich apples like Jeff Bezos, who happens to own the Washington Post, who possessed real capital, you know, the first or second richest man in the world, depending on your numbers, with millions of poverty-stricken oranges, who are the poor people who only have debt. And this is Kessler's argument, that because the poor have debt, whereas the wealthy have capital, you can't compare the two, right? He's saying people in the bottom half have essentially no wealth, as debt cancels out whatever assets they may have. So he's saying you can't compare Jeff Bezos with the poor, because the poor have debt, he has capital. So they have negative equity. No, I'm saying if this is your fact check, then like doesn't this bring into question the whole task of fact checking? And this is, but also applies on the. Within the Democratic Party itself, and its sort of partisans, and also some of its journalistic advocates, who for the last few years, you know, that message, America is already great, had the message that Bidenomics worked, the economy is great, and we have the facts to prove it. There's a fellow Democratic politician, not successful politician, but he has some prominence on Twitter, Will Stensel, who, you know, would write, like, you know, the economy is great, it's just that the media is, like, you know, not giving enough attention to how great the economy is. And he would write things like, the U.S. economy isn't doing well compared to other post-COVID economies. It's doing well compared to its own historical trends. It is objectively a very strong economy, an achievement made all the more remarkable because it's been done while climbing out of COVID. And he would like often argue that like all the talk about like people still struggling in the post-COVID economy is just vibes. It's just like people, and this is like was a real kind of message, and it had. And there was a lot of people. I mean, this guy's a little bit like, you know, just a Twitter guy. But I heard this from a lot of pro-democratic economists. Paul Krugman write this way in the New York Times, but there were many others who would say, like, you know, our numbers show, like, unemployment is down, inflation is down, things are great. And, you know, like why isn't... and their criticism of the media was that it wasn't giving enough attention to these great numbers. Well, you know... I always go back to, like I remember this libertarian writing once, well, you know, like, Mississippi is, like, has higher GDP than West Germany, right? And first of all, I've been to Mississippi, okay? But beyond that, like, the life expectancy in Mississippi is 11 years less than in Germany. Like, if you live in Mississippi right now, you can expect to live to be 70, 71. If you're in West Germany, you can expect to live to be 82, 83. So I don't really care what your GDP numbers are if, like, you know, like, you're losing a decade of your life in that economy. And certainly just citing GDP doesn't ignore the whole question of, you know, how the wealth is distributed. You know, like, as Kessler says, well, if half the population has negative wealth, we don't count them, right? So all these, like, economic numbers used as fact-checking in a very kind of, you know, I would say maybe delusional way to say that, you know, if you just show the GDP numbers, you know, these facts should trump everything. You know, I would just look at the results of the election. I think the elections is a pretty clear indication that, like, you know, this sort of argument did not convince people, nor do I think it should have convinced people. Getting near the end of the talk, but I think that there's other examples in which fact-checking, this regimen of fact-checking, this discourse of disinformation, has shut down debate. And one is the sort of, you know, the lab leaks theory. Now I believed, and I still actually pretty strongly believe, just based on my reading of the natural sciences, that, like, the COVID was actually of natural origins. It's very rare for it to something like a lab leak to happen. But having said that, I don't think that the people who believe in lab leak should be automatically dismissed as conspiracy theorists or cranks. And I think it's now become an open issue and it is being debated. But there was a period in which it got that label. And I think that's a case in which, you know, something that should be legitimately discussed was not. And I say this as someone who's on the other side of that issue. I don't believe in lab leak, but I was very concerned. And the other example, which maybe comes to mind, is a journalist for the Ottawa Citizen, Dave Puglisi, who was accused in Parliament by Chris Alexander, using parliamentary protection. He said, well, this guy's a Russian asset. And everyone sees that rhetoric used quite a bit. Sometimes used against politicians like Tulsi Gabbard, but sometimes used against journalists like Glenn Greenwald, where these are people you may agree or disagree with on certain issues, certainly with Greenwald. There's no evidence that these people are Russian assets, but this language of Russian assets and of disinformation is used to, I think, shut down conversations that are uncomfortable. And in the case of Dave Faglisi, I think it's the uncomfortable conversation is that the Canadian state, going back to the 1940s, has a long history of coddling Nazi war criminals across many governments, many generations. And he has written about this. And there are people who are very uncomfortable with this and are more than willing to use the language of disinformation to discredit that. And I think we have to be aware that, it's that fact-checking bubble has allowed this, and we have to, like, the problem is that, like, if you set up a world where we have the facts, we're the arbiter of facts, and you don't have the facts, we tell you what the facts are, right? I think that's alienating, and it's going to breed mistrust, and has the exact opposite effect of what you would want. And there's a very great article in The Walrus from 2021, which I would encourage people to look at, by Vivian Fairbanks, who ran the fact-checking department of The Walrus for 2 years, and really came to have, believes, as I do, fact-checking, crucial part of real journalism. This is something we all have to do. It's such an incredible thing for me as a writer when I have an article fact-checked and I really get someone who had gone over every quote and every detail, often embarrassing how many mistakes I had put into the first draft, but also heartening that, like, you know, someone or a group of people have checked this. Like, it's so vital to what we are. But if it's used as a weapon, if it's used as a way of setting ourselves up with a greater authority than we have, and also shutting people out, then it has the opposite effect. It doesn't reinforce our sense of facts. It actually makes people distrustful. So Vivian Fairbanks wrote, "Sometimes it feels like even using the term fact check online has become a way to single membership in the group of people interested in rational and moral superiority." I think that aspect of sort of unearned moral superiority. And then maybe this gets to the other issue, the question, do you go on Joe Rogan? How many people have listened to Joe Rogan? Okay, so, the one time I listened to it, they had a Navy pilot who had seen UFOs. I was kind of interested because the pilot seemed very rational. He had this description of an interesting experience, and he seemed like, okay, I'm listening along. It's a very long show, so I'm just, doing the dishes and cleaning the house and listening. And then at some point, at that point, he kind of had me, because he's doing the spirit of, I'm just asking questions, asking, like, the questions anyone would have of someone who came up with a story like that, but making it more and more plausible with that sort of, engagement. And then at some point, Rogan started talking about, like, Renaissance and medieval paintings and how they had, like, these weird creatures, and of course they were space aliens. Now, I don't know anything about the Navy or, what these evidence of UFOs are, but I know a little bit about, medieval and Renaissance things, and those are not space aliens. This is it's this curious mix of, the sort of interview style that one would like to have on the CBC, on the queue, a real thoughtful inquiry combined with an openness to, crack pottery. And it's a real question, the political question is, should you go on? And Bernie Sanders went on the Rogan show in 2020, got a huge amount of flack for it, you're legitimizing this crackpot. But now all the Democrats are saying, like, oh man, we should have gone on Joe Rogan. and so this is the changing kind of landscape. And to me, the whole question is, as journalists, maybe the rethink that we have to do is, with a lot of these questions, we have to think about, not why people got the facts wrong or why they think these things, but where they're coming from. And especially in a story like, we'll talk about RFK Jr., because Andrew knows a lot about the Kennedys, but I mean, RFK Jr. really started from a lot of positions that I think a lot of us would share, distrust of Big Pharma, belief. I mean, it is absolutely the case that, like, Big Pharma was, encouraging people to use, like, painkillers that they shouldn't, causing the fentanyl crisis, distrust of, and it, you know, he became on board and led them to, you know, like a place where, you know, now he thinks, you know, HIV doesn't cause AIDS. And so it's a real, you know, that direction is bad, but then one can't reject the initial questions. And I think a lot of the stuff that we're seeing of people's skepticism and doubt and even distrust of what we do comes from real places. It comes from good places, and we have to meet them at those good places, and that's how we can engage them so that they don't end up at the bad places. So that's my big thought on all this.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
An O'Reilly Auto Parts gift card is the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy-for person. Give the gift of convenience from O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.